You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump rallied supporters in Milwaukee last night before a crowd of about 12,000 at UW-Milwaukee Panther Arena. He spoke for an hour and a half, and his campaign trip collided with last night's Democratic presidential debate in Des Moines, the last one ahead of the Iowa caucus. Do you follow campaign rallies? Are they enough to convince you to vote for a candidate? What stuck out to you about President Trump's message in Wisconsin last night, a battleground state? We're at 800-642-1234. Alana Watson is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee, and she covered last night's rally. Alana, thanks for being here.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
So what was the mood like at the rally last night? What did you feel?
There was a lot of energy last night, from people waiting outside to get into the arena to people actually being in the arena. People were dancing the whole time with music playing in the background. People were trying to get a hold of each other. You heard people yelling each other's names back and forth across the arena. So the energy was extremely high before the president even got to the arena, which was kind of insane. But once the president really started talking, that's when a lot of energy came out.
What was President Trump's main message for Wisconsin last night?
Mainly, President Trump was focusing on keeping America safe. He put a lot of focus on the military and security and the confrontation with Iran.
And less than a week ago, the president held a similar campaign rally in Ohio, where he really celebrated his decision to order the drone strike that killed the top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Here is the president last night.
Soleimani was responsible for murdering and wounding thousands of Americans and was actively planning new attacks, but we stopped them cold. And frankly, they already started the attack, as you saw in Baghdad, on our very large embassy in Baghdad. That was already started.
So, Alana, what did the president have to say about the U.S. tension between Iran and what's going on there now?
You know, he didn't have much of new information to really give the audience. Basically, the clip that you played was basically what he said throughout the entire night. However, he did say that Iran is stepping down. He said there's no other confrontation. So he said that is something that the American people can be excited about, that there's nothing else going on with Iran right now.
He also mentioned rebuilding the U.S. military. What was his focus there?
Yes, absolutely. He said after years of defense cuts, he said he was able to rebuild the U.S. military to a point that it's never been before. He said that it was more lethal, more advanced, and more powerful. And that was his main focus during his entire speech, was keeping America safe because of how strong the military is.
How did the crowd respond to his references to the military?
The crowd was excited. You know, he mentioned that this is something that not everybody can do, and that, you know, the men and women that are serving our country right now, they are doing it out of their hearts, and that the American people can be proud that soldiers are fighting for our country.
Talking with Alana Watson, she is WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, and she covered last night's campaign rally in Milwaukee, where President Trump spoke before about 12,000 supporters. Your insights welcome, 800-642-1234. Alana, let's turn to the topic of trade, and here is the president.
Tomorrow we'll also be signing our Phase 1 trade deal with China, massively boosting exports of products made and produced right here in the great state of Wisconsin.
Okay, so on the topic of trade, as you said, tomorrow means today on this Phase 1 trade deal with China. What do we know there?
Yes, so the president actually, he went back and said that it could be signed this week or it could be signed next week. So it's kind of up in the air, but I mean, that means that it could come soon. He said that the trade with China will help bring more products to Wisconsin in general. So really focusing on the dairy industry.
Yeah, what did he say about dairy at all? Because Wisconsin lost 10% of its dairy farms last year.
Right, exactly. I think around 700,000 farms were shut down, mainly because of tariffs. And the president said that the tariffs that he's creating will actually be fair to almost all of the dairy markets. And those same tariffs are what put the state's dairy industry at risk. So it's kind of unclear what exactly the president is going to do to help the dairy industry here in Wisconsin.
Did he mention at all the new NAFTA deal, the new trade deal that replaces NAFTA, the USMCA?
Yes, absolutely. He did mention that. He said basically the same thing, that he hopes to have that signed within the next couple weeks. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
So during the 2016 election, President Trump won Wisconsin by less than 23,000 votes. And as he seeks re-election, did he make any future promises to the people of Wisconsin? Because we have, of course, the eye on Foxconn.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, the president didn't make any mention of Foxconn during his speech last night, which I found kind of interesting. A few promises that he made to Wisconsin is keeping unemployment rates down. He said that the unemployment rate right now in the state is the lowest it's been in history, thanks to his administration. He also made a promise to keep up with the judiciary appointments. And he also focused on the African-American and Hispanic unemployment rates that he said that he was going to continue to bring down. That was his main focus for Wisconsin.
Well, on the topic of the impeachment inquiry, the House is expected to vote today to transmit impeachment articles against President Trump to the Senate, allowing the trial to begin this week. How did he address the upcoming trial?
Basically, I mean, he said that it was a hoax and that he will be still in office. I guess he's hoping that he will still be in office. He basically said the whole thing was a hoax, that the Democrats are wasting their time and that he's doing great things for the American people.
And last night, a final debate was held for six Democratic presidential candidates ahead of the Iowa caucus in February. Did he point to any of his Democratic rivals last night? Did he make any references there?
Absolutely. He talked about Senator Bernie Sanders quite a bit during his speech last night. And it was kind of interesting. He basically said that the Democrats were not able to protect America. That was kind of his focus there when talking about Bernie and also talking about the Democrats put together. There was actually a Bernie supporter there that was actually kicked out of the rally. He talked about Bernie quite a bit last night.
You also covered some protests earlier in the day. What did you hear there?
The protests were basically focused on health care. There, I spoke with the mayor of Milwaukee, as well as a few doctors, saying that Trump has been focusing on getting rid of Obamacare, but he hasn't made it clear what that replacement will be. And because of that, a lot of Americans are losing health insurance, which is really, really making a lot of people sick because they can't go to the doctor. And it's also making prescription drug prices go up as well.
Well, Alana, thank you so much for joining us.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
Alana Watson is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee, and she covered President Trump's rally last night in downtown Milwaukee. Coming up, we're approaching the peak of this year's flu season, and a Wisconsin physician is here to give us an update on the spread of flu and how to try to avoid it. Do you work in a school? Have you noticed a lot of students out sick? Join in 800-642-1234 with your flu-related questions. Back in a moment, more conversation here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about influenza here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it puts out a weekly flu report. It estimates that so far this season there have been At least 9.7 million flu illnesses and 4,800 deaths from the flu. And it's not too late to get vaccinated. What questions do you have about this year's dominant flu strain? Influenza B is hitting children hard. Have kids been out sick at your school? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. James Conway is a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the Associate Director for Health Sciences in the Global Health Institute. Dr. Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us right now about the spread of flu this season?
Well, it's been an interesting season. It started a little earlier than usual and started in both the southeast and southwestern United States at the same time, and then has gradually worked its way north and has hit here in December. The most interesting thing has been the strains that are circulating. You know, we tend to start out most seasons with influenza A, and then kind of move towards influenza B kind of later in the season. This year, we were surprised by the fact that it started out as a predominantly type B circulating strains, but coupled with that was then the H1N1 2009 outbreak strain circulating of the A strain at the same time. So we've got about two-thirds of the cases have been this B strain, and about a third have been the H1N1 A strain.
And I understand B strain hits children particularly hard?
Yeah, it's been traditionally the viral strain that really hits kids the worst. I mean, that's what we've seen already this year. So there's been about 32 pediatric deaths so far that have already been attributed mostly in healthy, unimmunized kids, which is, you know, significantly higher than most years at this early part of the season.
And UW Health in particular, is seeing an uptick in year-over-year hospitalizations to date for flu. Is that just because flu season has just started earlier? What are you noticing there in hospitalizations?
Yeah, I think it's been an earlier season than usual for most of the facilities. And I think that's been the thing that's really stuck out for most people. As overall, I think the severity for the adults and older individuals has been about the same as what it is this time of year. So it's really been primarily the number of outpatients, especially pediatric patients, I think that people have really been noting.
One thing everyone wants to know is how well is the flu vaccine protecting people this year?
Yeah, you always hear these numbers thrown around. I mean, I think early in the season it's really hard. I think about 50% is about the protection rate we're seeing. And you got to be careful when you look at those numbers, because obviously some of the media really likes to sort of belittle the vaccine as being not particularly useful. There's two things we look at. One is, in a black and white world, is it completely protecting you against the disease? And so that's where they're getting this ballpark 50% of people that get the vaccine don't get sick at all if they're exposed. But the thing you have to recognize is that if people get sick and have had the vaccine, they tend to have much milder disease. And so what we've really seen is that it's the unimmunized people that are the ones that are having the most severe disease.
Remind us who should get the flu shot.
Well, pretty much everybody at this point. You know, we started out with it being the older individuals and those in high-risk situations that have underlying chronic diseases. But over time, we've realized that the benefit to society and to individuals really suggests that everybody can benefit from the vaccine. So it's basically everybody 6 months and up should be vaccinated. And it's really not too late to get vaccinated at this point. We're kind of overall at about the standard average of where we expect to be for the number of cases, which means that we still really haven't hit the bulk of the season, which really comes in after the holidays as kids go back to school and start to recirculate these things. And so January, February really tend to be the peak times. And so there's plenty of vaccine available. And for those people that haven't been vaccinated, there's still plenty of benefit from doing so.
Talking with Dr. James Conway, he's a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're looking at the flu season and what we see so far. Dr. Conway, one child under the age of 10 recently died due to the flu. How can parents and teachers help protect kids from the flu?
Obviously, immunization is the key thing. And, you know, as much as we can, trying to get people to maintain some level of infection control quarantine type stuff. So for people that do have illness, either themselves or their kids, you know, this is especially the time of the year that It's the kind thing to do is try to stay out of circulation and stay home as much as possible. The other is that, you know, for most respiratory illnesses that you think about, you know, the common colds and things like that, fever is not a particularly noteworthy feature for most people. And so if you've got respiratory symptoms with fever, you know, especially if you've got muscle aches or headache, the nice thing about influenza is that it's fully treatable by antiviral drugs, unlike a lot of the other colds and things like that. So if you've got a respiratory illness with fever, it's a really good idea to call and check in with your provider, and plenty of providers in the region will even prescribe antiviral flu medications if you meet certain criteria to be considered likely to have flu, not even make you go in and get tested or anything. And it's partially for people's best interest just to not have to be out and dealing with the winter and stuff when they're sick, but it's also to protect other people in those medical offices from being exposed unnecessarily. But this is a, you know, very treatable virus. There's a couple of different products on the market that have good activity against both flu A and B. Both oseltamivir and baloxavir are readily available and really can prevent most of the severity of the disease. The other thing to mention is that, you know, while they work best in the first 48 hours of the illness, you know, we recognize that they still have some benefit, at least in preventing the real severity of the disease, even if they're started on the third, fourth day. So people and providers really shouldn't be reluctant to provide the antivirals. And there's really very little viral resistance in the country. So we're looking at, you know, probably around 99% of the strains circulating are susceptible to these antiviral medications.
Well, even with the positive effects of the antiviral medications, are we any closer in eradicating influenza?
No, I mean, it's still such a poor virus at replicating that it just constantly makes mistakes. And so there's this constant, what we call antigenic drift during the season that they're constantly mutating. So to get a really good vaccine, the need is to try to figure out some part of the virus that doesn't change over time that would allow good immunity then against that stable part of the virus. So there's obviously a lot of interest. I mean, this is kind of the holy grail of vaccines in many ways. And the federal government is putting more funding and effort into try to support the development of those vaccines. But at this point, they're still a ways off.
Well, it sounds like us humans, we're always making mistakes and we're always changing.
That's absolutely true.
So help us understand the difference between influenza A and B.
Yeah, I mean, there's three strains of influenza, A, B, and C. And the A's are the ones that tend to recombine as they enter into animals and humans and back and forth. So when you hear about bird flu and swine flu, those A strains that have the ability to infect multiple species. And so as they bounce around between species, they tend to pick up and lose different parts of the virus, and they tend to be much more aggressive. There's really just two strains of influenza B that circulate, Victoria and Yamagata strains. And, you know, I think many people are aware that for many, many years, the flu vaccines only had three strains. So they would have two A strains every year, usually an H1N1 and an H3N2 strain, and then they would have just one or the other of the B strains. And even when I was younger in my career, I always wondered, like, why are we only, you know, essentially flipping a coin on the Bs? And so the pharmaceutical companies some years ago finally realized that there was benefit putting both B strains in. But the problem is that, you know, the WHO and CDC still have to make an educated guess way back in January, February, of what's going to circulate the following year to design the vaccine, give the companies time to actually make the strains. And so that's the problem, and that's why we get this, you know, something below 70% of efficacy, is that the viruses continue to change, and the best that you can do is sort of look in a crystal ball and guess what's coming. Bees, like I said, tend to come up later in the season usually, and they have traditionally been milder, especially in older individuals. So, you know, currently the rate of hospitalizations for over 65s are actually a little bit below where they usually are because it's such a predominantly B series. And I think people have always wondered why. I think part of it's that they're just less aggressive viruses. I think the other is that since there's only two strains, most people by the time they get into adulthood have had experience either with vaccines or with having actually had one of these flu strains. And so they tend to attack older people in much lower rates. And so that's part of the reason why kids are so vulnerable. And, you know, nationally, unfortunately, when we look at the number of kids who have been vaccinated for flu, you know, unfortunately, we only end up in maybe 25 or 30% of kids in many areas have gotten their flu vaccine. So that combination of an early B strain, the lack of experience with those B strains, and the lack of vaccination in kids is why they're really the epicenter for this current outbreak.
Well, Dr. Conway, stay well. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, Kate. Happy to do it anytime. Have a great day.
Dr. James Conway is a professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up, a Purdue University professor explains a connection between attending live theater and improved learning outcomes for students. Do you recall learning about theater in middle school or high school? Did you like the class? Do you have a better appreciation for the arts because of it? Join in with your experiences being in plays, acting, theater, attending live theater. We're at 800-642-1234. Back after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring the educational benefits of taking in live theater or performing in plays. It's a conversation about the arts here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So one example is Hamilton, winner of 11 Tony Awards. It's credited with sparking kids' interest in history. The Hamilton Education Program reaches 250,000 kids nationwide, and it runs through 2020. Here is President Thomas Jefferson, who is an antagonist in Act Two.
So what did I miss? What did I miss? Virginia, my home sweet home, I want to give you a kiss. I've been in Paris meeting lots of different ladies. I guess I basically missed the late 80s. I traveled the wide, wide world and came back to this.
Yes. Are you a drama teacher? Do you take your students to see theater productions? How does that influence learning? Do you not appreciate live theater? What turns you off to the experience? We're at 800-642-1234. And Shanahan is chair of the Department of Theater at Purdue University and associate professor of theater, where she teaches acting, directing, dramaturgy, and gender studies. And welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I'm really pleased to be here.
And you teach students from all walks of life about theater, majors, non-majors. What do we know today about what seeing live theater can do to us from an educational standpoint?
Well, one of the things I love about teaching theater, both to students who have chosen it as a field to pursue as a major or a minor, and students who are doing it for interest or to fulfill a credit in a core curriculum or a general education course, is that we really get to see the power of the art form to inspire learning and to inspire connections between human beings, to inspire engagement in our lives, in our civic discourse. So teaching in those various venues to those various students really gives you insight into the unique power of it. I think that what theater has to offer as a way of study is that it's uniquely embodied. So similar to dance, we're bringing our bodies to the equation. Unlike fields of study that are more pursued intellectually, more traditionally through, as we would say, book learning or traditional classroom settings, theater allows us to engage with a variety of subjects with our whole selves, including our bodies and all that that brings to the table in terms of emotion.
So whether you're in the audience or you have a role on stage, there's this sort of human-to-human connection going on?
Well, I'm glad that you brought up the audience, because in addition to the embodied feature of theater practice, it's also communal. And that's what's, I think, uniquely powerful about the form, that combination of the embodied and the communal together, excuse me, and that sure. we're sharing that in a live present in the audience as well. Yes, so the audience has an embodied experience as well.
Well, let's take a call now. Matt is joining us from Johnson Creek. Hi, Matt.
Hello. So, first of all, I'd like to point out that a knowledge of theater won Ken Jennings $1 million. But beyond that, I think that engagement in theater, specifically in high school, that includes speech and forensics and one act, kind of helps with that public speaking. And I think some of the more successful people I've known have been able to deliver their ideas and are effectively speaking in front of groups. And that's how you can get ahead in life.
Matt, did you do theater or forensics public speaking as a kid in high school and middle school?
I did, all kinds. And specifically forensics, you know, when you talk about extemporaneous speaking and storytelling, and these are things that allow you to be able to communicate, like your guest said, but there's multiple ways to communicate, be it business or, you know, just in your daily life and if with other people. That's, I believe, how you're successful, getting your ideas across.
Matt, thanks so much for the call. And, you know, Matt sees a real leg up when it comes to public speaking, learned through theater.
Well, there are certainly very practical skills. I completely agree with Matt. And when I'm teaching students who are pursuing a business degree or indeed a degree in medicine or sciences, as he says, there are direct skills that one learns not only in public speaking, but also in framing an argument, basic ideas of storytelling, starting from one point and getting to another in order to persuade an audience of something. Those are very basic skills, which, as he says so rightly, transfer in a variety of different areas.
Let's explore the format for a moment. Why do you think audience members connect more with characters, people on stage, versus seeing the same plot in a movie?
Well, I think there's a unique power in being in literally in the same room, being in the present moment with other human beings. Certainly there's huge power in watching a movie, and I and, you know, many folks who practice theater love going to movies as well. But there's something about being alert, awake, and in a shared moment of presence that has a unique capacity to engage our bodies, to engage a sense of connection, to engage our capacities for empathy with another human being, and not only with the actors on stage, but also with the audience members around us. And so there's this sense of a shared experience that's different from film because it's not happening in front of us with actors experiencing things in the moment.
Talking with Ann Shanahan, she's chair of the theater department at Purdue University. We're looking at this connection between live theater and learning. You can join in. Parents, do you take your kids to local plays and musicals? How do they respond? Are they in them? What do you think this does for their development? And kids, do you enjoy attending live theater? What's your favorite play? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And, you know, we often in high school would read plays out loud rather than to ourselves. What does this do for students as far as comprehension, reading out loud?
Well, as opposed to other written forms, other forms of prose, literature, poetry, theater is meant to be read out loud, which is a form of embodiment. Your voice is in your body, and so you're experiencing the text through your voice, through your body, as it's meant to be expressed in interaction with another character or with directly with the audience. And so that's part of how it's part of its essential form. It's part of how it is. It's really only experience. You can study drama as a piece of literature, and folks do, notably with playwrights like Shakespeare, where it's got poetic qualities. But that poetry is really only fully realized when it's read out loud and vocalized. Its qualities aren't even fully expressed on the page. they happen when they're spoken out loud.
Mm. I want to ask you about the rise of Hamilton over the last 5 years. I can't believe it's been this long, the popular musical. How do you think telling stories in this really creative light affects our comprehension? What do you see out of Hamilton?
Well, I think it's a profound example of the power of theater to move the world forward, to advance our social discourse, to radically alter our social discourse. Being able to have actors portray this history that contains a certain bias, to be able to break that open and have that embodied by a diverse set of actors embodying these characters differently literally breaks open the history so that we can consider the history differently and we can share it in unique ways that were not open prior to something like Hamilton.
Well, it might have been also a big breakthrough for gender and ethnicity that has not been customarily represented on stage. How big of an issue do you see is this as a deterrent for audiences who don't see themselves on stage?
I think that those historic biases on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality have persisted for so long that we're at this really important point of, I would even call it, revolution, where theater artists and audiences are using the art form to break those things open so that we're experiencing stories that we that culturally were not at the forefront of our dialogue, and it's enriching everyone. It's providing opportunities for folks to tell their stories, to see their stories on stage, and to see other stories on stage that haven't been part of the wider discourse. I think it's hugely profound and revolutionary, and it has a lot to do with the power of theater. Theater, I think, is at the forefront of a cultural dialogue.
Let's take a call now. Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I just want to put a plug in for parents. Take your kids to live theater. My brother and I were taken all over southern Wisconsin. We got hooked very, very young. Perform on stage in junior high, middle school, high school, and into our adulthood. Just the lifelong nature of being able to perform and share the art form with audiences. I mean, you don't see many 70-year-old football players, but by gosh, I've been on stage with 70-year-olds and just still love it.
What's your favorite play, Kevin? What was your favorite production?
Oh, my goodness.
That like picking a favorite
child?
How do you
pick your favorite child? Exactly. Each production has its own pluses and minuses. The live action back and forth with the audience, you just never know what's going to happen. The energy that feeds back and forth, it's truly a natural high, and I'm addicted.
Oh, Kevin, thank you so much for sharing that. We're looking at the impact of the arts and theater. Anne Shanahan is our guide. She chairs the Department of Theater at Purdue University. You can join in with your experiences. Do you participate in community theater productions where you live? What do you hope the audience gains from your theater group on stage? Where do you think live theater in Wisconsin is falling short right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Anne Shanahan right here on the Ideas Network. Research finds that students benefit from school field trips to see live theater. We're looking at the cognitive impact of live arts here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So in one study, researchers at the University of Arkansas found measurably higher levels of tolerance and stronger command of the plot and vocabulary when seeing a play versus watching the same work in movie form. So mode of delivery mattered, not just the content. Do you recall your favorite high school play you were part of? Did you see live theater at the holidays? What did you see? What sticks with you as your most memorable theater production? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. The head of Purdue University's theater department, Ann Shanahan, stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Sarah joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was just calling because theater has been a big part of my life and my children's life. We've been very involved with our local community theater, children's theater in Eau Claire. I started doing plays with my daughter, who is now 19, when she was around 10. And I was in Mary Poppins with her 5 years ago. And then now I've just been cast along with my 12-year-old to do Mary Poppins again in March.
Oh, wow. And, things really come around.
Yes. I was also an Annie with both of my girls two different times. So, and I just really feel that theater has helped shape my kids. It's made them more confident. It's made them know how to problem solve and work as a team. And then also as far as going to live theater, I feel like there's benefits to kids being able to see that art and then also perform as well. And it uses different parts of a child's brain, so it's just beneficial for everyone.
Sarah, thank you so much. And it sounds like this has been a real bonding experience for Sarah and her kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was listening to Sarah's experience and thinking about how that much that resonates with mine and the students that I teach and my colleagues, that once one is experiences the power of theater, it really becomes a vital part of one's life, and many folks start as Sarah's kids did at a young age. I love her references to that confidence building and that problem solving and working as a group, in addition to what she referenced about using different parts of the brain, that using our body and experiencing things in a shared present moment with other human beings actually affects our brain in different ways and allows us to process information differently.
And it's interesting to me that it's one thing for the kid to be on stage and the parent to be in the audience, but, you know, Sarah's up there too with her kid, and that seems to be also a very supportive atmosphere.
Well, one of the things that the previous caller commented on was the 70-year-old on stage. That it, you know, to your points about Hamilton, it's a profoundly and deeply inclusive experience that allows for an entire community to come together. And we're trying to look at ways to examine how we can get even better about that by creating ever more accessible experiences, certainly as we've talked about on the level of race and gender, ethnicity, but in terms of modes of perception and accessibility for greater and greater audiences and also for actors, so that we're thinking differently about what kinds of provisions are happening on stage for actors of all sorts of different abilities.
Let's bring in Julie now in Appleton. Hi, Julie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling today to encourage people to not only go to like nationally well-known acts or like the PAC in Appleton, but also to don't forget to support the local high school plays. I recently went to Denmark and saw Mamma Mia here a couple months ago and was blown away by what these young people are able to do.
And Julie, so, I assume that the high school play was right in your neighborhood, right in your community.
Well, close by. It was in Denmark. I went to support one of my colleagues' kids that were in it.
Oh, my goodness. And so you went all the way to Denmark to see the play.
Absolutely, yes.
Wow.
And the kids did such a fabulous job. And, again, sometimes we only hear the negative things about young people, unfortunately. And getting to come and see these group of diverse students come together, and the friendships that I have heard that have been made between the high school kids and some of the middle schoolers are fantastic. And I can only assume that going out into like plays in college. I was in a play in at college, and you get to interact with intergenerations and the relationships that can be developed that way.
Julie, thank you so much for that. And, theater can take you places around the world.
Absolutely. And it's got that universal capacity for communication. I'm just thinking about something, as we're thinking about the power of theater for young students as well as high school age students. You know, I'm thinking about in the 60s when film and television were really making their heyday and were becoming ever more available. In every household, there was a television set. You know, we began to question, is theater a dead art form? Is it dying, and is it better achieved through film or television? And instead, I think what we're seeing, and I'm particularly thinking about it with high school age and students who are starting college, which is, of course, where I am, is that what we're seeing is ever more the need for the in-the-moment interaction that's not in front of a screen, that's not in front of a computer, that's not in front of our phones, but is actually in that present moment involving folks' bodies, that there's documented increased rates of depression and anxiety in this generation of student. And I really think we're going to start to be able to see how that live interaction and that working in a community that theater provides has an impact on that, not only in learning, but also in larger issues of mental health and happiness.
We're talking with Purdue University's Ann Shanahan, who chairs the theater department there, and we're looking at this intersection of live theater and learning. Let's take another call now. Sharon is in Minocqua. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, this is such a great program, another great morning program. I live in Wisconsin now, but I used to live in Hawaii and worked on a theatrical company which did educational productions around natural history themes and concepts. And my comment really is about how theater engages so many of the arts, not just the performance art. There are, especially in educational settings, there's so much that goes into the designing the backgrounds and the costumes and even coming up with the sets and being creative. I love what the previous caller was talking about, too. And because there's kind of a magic about seeing it live, perform live. With movies and television, a lot of the stuff happens in the background that we never see, but on the stage, everything is right in front of everyone. And so you have to be very creative as to how you're creating your production and how you're, actually directing it. Mm. So I'll listen to the comments off of the air.
Oh, but, Sharon, thank you so much. Creativity takes so many forms on stage, Anne.
Mm-hmm. I love that comment, and it's so much of why I love the arts and why I chose theater, because it's this, I call it the perfect art. It's this combined form. It combines the visual. It combines music often, even in the speech, that's a sort of movement or a sort of music. It combines obviously the literature that we've talked about. So it's this sort of total art form. Not only a combination of arts, but also you can study anthropology, sociology, as we've mentioned with Hamilton, history, certainly English. It really allows for one to combine as many interests as one has and find a way to creatively communicate them.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
It's really been my pleasure, Kate. The calls have been great, and this has been an honor.
Ann Shanahan is chair of the Department of Theater at Purdue University. She's an associate professor of theater. Just ahead, we examine privacy laws in the age of commercial genetic testing. A UW genetics professor and a legislative analyst break down their latest research. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.